If you enjoy The Spectator's podcast, why not subscribe to the magazine as well? You can get 12 weeks of The Spectator for just £12, plus a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher if you go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. This is a podcast-only deal, and we hope you take us up on it.
Welcome to Holy Smoke, The Spectator's religion podcast. I'm Damien Thompson. Pope Francis, as we all know, is critically ill with pneumonia in the Gemelli Hospital in Rome. There are prayer vigils for him all over the world. And this has inevitably raised the question of what might happen should he not survive. Obviously, there will be a conclave, which, by a rather dark coincidence, is a subject that is on lots of people's minds, because the film Conclave, which I think is rather good, despite certain implausibility in the plot, though not as good as the fantastic thriller, it has been nominated for an Oscar. And indeed, the cast of Conclave, who include Ralph Fiennes and the great Stanley Tucci and Isabella Rossellini, have sent a message of goodwill to the ailing pontiff. The news is not good at all. And all sorts of people are asking, well, what is a conclave? What happens in a conclave? And there's an awful lot that is in the book, but not actually shown in the film. I think one of my criticisms of the film was that it would have been even more nail-biting and exciting if we'd seen more of the process of those cumulative ballots. We're very lucky to be joined today by one of the world's most distinguished Catholic canon lawyers, Dr. Kurt Martins, who's a professor of canon law at the Catholic University in America, in Washington, D.C., and he's here to tell us a little bit about the process of a conclave, the very complicated traditional sequence of events that begins when a pope breathes his last and ends when his successor walks onto the balcony of St. Peter's. I remember being there in 2005 when Cardinal Ratzinger walked out as Pope Benedict. That was a very happy moment for me and for many other people. Who could have guessed that his pontificate would have ended in such a crushing anticlimax? Anyway, Kurt, welcome to Holy Smoke. Could you begin by taking us through the process leading up to the conclave? Because that's very often when the crucial decisions are made, often in informal conversations inside the Vatican once the cardinals begin their pre-conclave meetings. So if you could just spell out, for me, as well as for everybody else, the precise sequence of events.
Absolutely. So let's start with the beginning. Obviously, everybody is fascinated by conclaves because of the movie Conclave that we all watched once, twice, or multiple times. I'm not going to tell you how many times I watched it.
I'm planning to watch it twice. I'm planning to watch it again today because I really loved it. Visually, it's magnificent.
Visually, it's a great movie. And thanks for having me here on your podcast. It's a great movie, visually, etc. Obviously, I watched it as the super nerd conclave guy with my flashlight and a pen and paper in the movie theater. But that's it.
I want to hear what they got wrong and what they got right. I'm fascinated.
Well, actually, I must admit that in terms of the process, it was more or less accurate. There were some little things that only someone like me would have picked up on, because obviously that's what you do when you're a nerd. However, in general, the whole layout of what happens, even with the chatter that happens in between sessions, was pretty accurate. I wasn't too keen on that moment in the beginning when a pope is zipped up in a body bag. That's not what happens. The body of a deceased Roman pontiff is treated with much more respect than that. The moment where they take off his ring is very interesting. Obviously, that happens at some point during the general congregations where the College of Cardinals takes possession of the fisherman's ring, of the leaden seal, and all other things that are used to authenticate documents, and they destroy that artifacts, or they make them unusual so that documents cannot be forged. The fact that that happens in the room of the deceased pontiff is a little bit exaggerated, but I assume that that is because of the cinematographic element of
So they take a hammer to the seal, don't they? Or they have a special implement for breaking the seal.
They don't. Actually, what I was told was that they just scratch it so that it can no longer be used. Because typically these things are also artifacts, and so they want to keep them for posterity. There is a scratch through it, or it's broken. In the past, the idea was that the ring was broken with a hammer, indeed, or something heavy that could break the ring, and the ring would shatter, hopefully, in 70 pieces, 7-0. Why was that? That was a symbol. It was at the time when the College of Cardinals was at a maximum of 70, 7-0. And the idea was it breaks in 70 pieces. And so that's the visual element of the power transferring from the one pope to the College of Cardinals in the interim, which is kind of fascinating. But that doesn't happen anymore. Same thing I thought you were going to say about the hammer, that they use that silver hammer to certify the death.
Check that he's dead. Do they knock him on?
They don't knock him on the, they don't knock him on the forefront anymore. Actually, research has shown that the last time it was probably used was for Pius IX in 1878 by his successor, Leo XIII, who was under Camerlengo at the time. So, no, they don't do that anymore. Imagine that ritual with when they hit him three times on the forefront and call him by his baptismal name. The first time that they did that, and there was still some response. Imagine they hit the second time a little bit harder to make sure that the third time there was no more response, right?
Just to make sure. I'm sure it happened in the Renaissance.
Exactly. So no, those things aren't anymore. But what happens actually in the new ritual that Pope Francis has approved last year, in April of last year, it happens all in a first stage in the chapel, the private chapel of the deceased Roman pontiff, where the Camerlengo and some clerics officially, during some liturgical celebration, ascertain the death of the Roman pontiff. And then that whole machinery is set into motion. And actually, what happens is two things. There is first, when we have a death of a Roman pontiff, there is the funeral, right? And everything that comes with that. And obviously, as you alluded to earlier, during the preparations for the funeral and that morning, obviously cardinals meet in smaller groups, in bigger groups. They have the official general congregations where they meet every day to take care of practical elements, to govern the church in the interim. Obviously, they talk about who's next, who would be a good pope, who would be the ideal person. And so what you saw in the movie Conclave, that talking, the chit-chat in the hallways, that happens during a conclave. That's not forbidden. And I'm pretty sure that cardinals have on their mind right now also the idea of what if the inevitable happens now or later, who is going to be in line? You always have to be careful with that. When John Paul II, in his last years of his pontificate, was severely ill, a number of cardinals were rumored as his possible successor. Obviously, they died before he died, so they weren't any more eligible. So you have to be careful with those papabili. Some don't make it to the finish line. So the funeral is one big thing. Keep in mind that between the death of the Roman pontiff and the beginning of the conclave, you have a minimum of 15 days. That accounts for, obviously, taking care of the funeral itself. But then also, you have the 9 days of mourning, the Novem Dialis, where for 9 consecutive days, you have solemn funeral rites for the deceased Roman pontiff. And in the meantime, you have also those general congregations going on. And so
let me just check this. These general congregations are cardinals, and they include cardinals over the age of 80. In other words, they include the entire College of Cardinals.
Yes, so you have to make a distinction between the conclave and what doesn't belong to the conclave. In the conclave, you only have the cardinals who are eligible to participate, that is those who are under the age of 80 the day before the vacancy occurs, right?
And that's at the moment, that's 138.
That's 138. That is going to drop down a little bit towards the end of the year. We will see what happens. So that's one thing. But anything else before and after the conclave, the cardinals over 80, the octogenarians, as I call them affectionately sometimes, they are able to participate. There's a distinction. Those who are under 80 must participate. those over 80 can participate.
And on that point, one point I wanted to make is that
sure.
To my mind, perhaps the greatest living cardinal is a nonagenarian. I think he's 94 years old, Cardinal Joseph Zen of Hong Kong, who's mm-hmm. been a campaigner for democracy and was the cardinal who warned against the diabolical pact with Beijing, which has seen the Catholic Church cede its authority mm-hmm. to the Chinese Communist Party, and indeed the Catholic Church, even in Rome, adopt some of the dreadful language of Sinicization. It was Cardinal Penn who famously said, quite accurately, that Cardinal Parolin has a poisoned mind. And it's a shame that he, because the Chinese have confiscated his passport, he can't be there to warn the cardinals of the dangers of electing Pietro Parolin. That's just my, well, it's not just my opinion as it happens. It's the opinion of very distinguished and brave campaigners for human rights. But anyway, that's my point.
Actually, that's not uncommon. A number of cardinals, I think about two of them, were not able to participate in some of the conclaves of the previous century because of communist regimes not allowing them to leave their country. One of them is Cardinal Vincenzi of Esztergom, Budapest at the time. He was in the American embassy confined and he couldn't leave the country until a deal was made.
And he was a heroic figure. And I just on a personal note, my late sister Carmel, who died of cancer when she was ill, my great friend, Father Benedict Keeley, whose praises I never cease to sing, drove a very long distance to her house with a relic of Cardinal Vincenzi. But it was a lovely thing, a lovely gesture, a lovely way to remember the heroic Cardinal Vincenzi.
Right. So those things happen, and it depends whether or not they can get him out of there. You'll see, though, that we saw that in 2005, 2013, twice, that most of the cardinals over the age of 80 will try to make it to Rome for these general congregations and participate in them.
Even though Zen, I make the point because, you know, imagine that the Pope were to die soon. I mean, Zen's presence might actually be a game changer. And you can imagine people in the Vatican not being keen for him to have a passport.
Well, they can always issue him a Vatican passport, a passport of the Holy See. So if he would have a diplomatic passport, depending on how they deal with that.
They won't. They won't. They don't want him there.
I cannot fix that. So that's above my pay grade. But it is important to note that those above the age of 80 can participate. And what is also important to note is that you mentioned Cardinal Parolin a little earlier. What is important to note is that those general congregations are presided over by the dean of the College of Cardinals, no matter what his age is. So technically speaking, the dean was just reconfirmed by Pope Francis, and so is the vice dean. So unless the dean dies or something happens to him, it's going to be Cardinal Re, the current dean of the College of Cardinals, if we have a conclave anytime soon, who is going to preside over that. But note that
Cardinal Giovanni Battista Re is over 90, isn't he?
He's over 90. I don't keep track of the birthdays.
91,
of
I think he is. He's worked in the Curia since 1963.
That's right. And he's a diplomat. So he comes also from that diplomatic career path. Re will preside over those general congregations. Then there is obviously the Camerlengo, who also has an important role to fulfill during that vacancy.
Both Cardinal Farrell.
That is Cardinal Farrell, correct. That's an American.
Mm-hmm. Irish-American he is. He was a very close associate of Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, or ex-Cardinal Theodore McCarrick. Indeed,
he was his auxiliary bishop.
He claims not to have known anything at all about what McCarrick was up to for many, many years. I think it's an utter disgrace that Farrell should be Camerlengo, but I'll shut up again. Okay.
Thank you. Normally, once I get a microphone, I don't give it away. I keep it forever.
I
let you interrupt me. You mentioned Cardinal Parolin earlier. So when the conclave starts, Ray obviously cannot participate in the conclave because he's over 80. And the question then is, who presides over the conclave? Is the senior of the cardinal bishops? And who is that? Who's an elector, obviously. Who is that? That's Cardinal Parolin. So regardless of what happens, Cardinal Parolin is the one who is going to preside over the conclave. So that's something worth of note to some extent, anyhow.
And he's senior because he's Secretary of State?
No, because the moment that there is a vacancy, however that vacancy occurs, through death of the Roman pontiff or resignation of the Roman pontiff, he's no longer secretary of state. He's the former secretary of state.
Right.
The moment that the pope dies or that the pope resigns and that the see becomes vacant, there is like an axe coming down. It's like the guillotine. All those curial heads lose their office, cease from office, period. They're no longer secretary of state. There are a number of exceptions, such as the Camerlengo, the major penitentiary, and things like that. But in principle, they all lose their office. And so he's no longer secretary of state. Now, the reason why he presides over the conclave is because he is a member of the rank of cardinal bishops, and he's the senior amongst them in terms of electors.
Could you just explain, because I don't think most people understand it. I didn't until, you know, recently.
Okay.
The difference between cardinal deacons, cardinal priests, and cardinal bishops, because they are all cardinals.
They're all cardinals, and it's kind of... It's great that you asked that question. I'll try to explain it in a concise way, but I'm not sure if I'm going to make that. The College of Cardinals is divided in three orders. Practically, it doesn't make any difference in the sense that they all have equal rights, etc. These orders is just a reflection of the fact that we keep intact that idea that the Pope is elected by the clergy of Rome. The clergy of Rome, who was that are the cardinals. And therefore, you have within the ranks of the cardinals, you have cardinal deacons, thinking they're the deacons of the former deacons of Rome, the cardinal priests, meaning the senior priests of Rome, and then the cardinal bishops, that is those bishops who hold the title to a suburbicarian diocese, that is one of the traditional suffragan dioceses of Rome, in the province of Rome, of which Rome is the metropolitan see. That's a lot of terminology to grasp.
I love it. I love the detail.
Well, Patrick.
That's why you're here, Professor.
Patrick said that he was told I'm a super conclave nerd. So I'm trying to.
Patrick is our producer, I should say. I'm very pleased.
So anyhow, these cardinal bishops. Are technically those who hold the title to a suburbicarian diocese. For instance, the cardinal bishop of Ostia, the cardinal bishop of Albano, but they don't have any jurisdiction anymore over those old dioceses because either these old dioceses have been folded into the diocese of Rome, so they're merely titular, or those dioceses have their own diocesan bishop. So you have someone who has the title of cardinal bishop and then another one who has the governance. So it's merely to have some ranks within the College of Bishops. And note that although we make a distinction between those ranks, the last real deacon in the College of Cardinals died somewhere at the beginning of the 20th century. So we haven't had real deacons. We've had mere priests in the College of Cardinals until 1962, until John the 23rd made a decision that all cardinals, if they lacked episcopal consecration, had to be ordained a bishop. And so now all cardinals are bishops unless they received a dispensation from receiving episcopal ordination by the Pope.
Such as Cardinal Dulles, for example.
Cardinal Dulles is an example of that. Most of the Jesuits, when they're created cardinals, they're usually somewhere in the Roman Curia or at one of the pontifical universities, at the Gregorian University usually, and they ask for a dispensation from receiving episcopal ordination because they're over 80 and their thing is, why bother? Let's just be a priest. Although they can wear...
Because I'm a cardinal anyway.
I'm a cardinal anyway. So they can
By the way, is Cardinal Timothy Radcliffe, is he a bishop?
No, he actually also asked for a dispensation and got one granted. So he's not a bishop. But an interesting question there is, for now, I think he's not yet 80. He's like on the border.
That's right. He's 79. Yeah.
He's 79. So I assume
he's going to... technically be elected Pope.
He could technically be elected Pope. Well, let me correct you there. He could technically, if he's not yet 80, he will participate in the conclave. However, even if he's over 80, he could be elected Pope.
Right. I see.
Who is in the conclave. It's not limited to the cardinals. It's not limited to bishops. It could be a priest or it could be even a lay person who qualifies to be ultimately ordained a priest, so a bishop, married and who has no impediments. That could be also, that person could also be elected pope. Obviously, that's theory, but it's a possibility. So we have to mention
all right. I've led you down these rabbit holes. I find them absolutely fascinating. But let's get on to the process of voting.
Correct.
As we know, there are successive ballots, and it's a very tense business indeed, because people's votes move fast, don't they? Allegiances change very quickly as it becomes clear. I think am I right in saying that the first vote is very often you vote for somebody out of politeness, out of friendship or something? It's not a serious vote.
That's correct. I would say that. I would say it's a polite vote, and I would also say it's most likely also an indicative vote. What do I mean by that? Until they enter into the conclave, people have chatted with each other. There have been rumors, murmurations, and things like that. But it's like when going into an exam, right? You only know your grade after the exam, after someone has written something down. This is the same thing. You don't know what the cards look like until the cards are distributed, right? And so that first day of the conclave, it actually starts in the morning with a votive mass for the Holy Spirit in St. Peter's Basilica. In the afternoon, they enter into conclave, right? In the Sistine Chapel, with that dramatic moment when the papal master of ceremony says, extra omnes, that's polite Latin for get all out of here. Only the cardinals remain then in the end, and they started voting. There's only one ballot that afternoon. And usually you see, okay, who leads? Where are the votes coming from? And then typically what we've seen in the past century is that a conclave moves rather fast. We're talking about 2-3 days, and that means two ballots each half day, two in the morning, two in the afternoon, until someone has a 2/3 majority. And during that, obviously, we don't have any records, at least official records of that. We have indiscretions. You can see that allegiances oftentimes shift quickly. If someone stalls at some point, can get a majority, but cannot get to that 2/3 majority, then all of a sudden you will see ballots shift.
Which is interesting because John Paul II actually suspended that rule and said that after a sufficient number of ballots, a simple majority would be okay, which I think helped Cardinal Ratzinger. But then Ratzinger, as Benedict, reinstated the 2/3 rule, didn't he? Did I get that right?
Is correct. However, let's nuance that for a bit. It may have helped Benedict. It may not. We will never know. That rule is instituted. And if you kind of do the math, which I've done as a super nerd, right, on a piece of paper, and you count all the number of ballots that are indicated in the Apostolic Constitution governing the election of the Roman Pontiff, and then you also take the maximum time that they have for a break, you end up at around 2 weeks into the conclave. So that's a long time, where the cardinals have, with a simple majority, the right to change the rule. Now, originally, John Paul II had put in his apostolic constitution that the cardinals could change the 2/3 majority with a simple majority to just a simple majority. Has that helped Benedict? Well, Benedict was elected after just 2 days, so we didn't even get there. So it's a
theory.
I doubted that that helped him. I doubted that cardinals would be threatened by the looming prospect that 2 weeks from now they could change the majority. Typically, the dynamics in a conclave are such that, as you just mentioned, those majorities shift. If someone doesn't attract more votes, cardinals are going to start voting on someone else, and then it shifts over. So I doubt that that would have helped Benedict so much. He got elected because simply they thought he was the best one.
Which he was.
To be elected.
But may I ask you about, and this, we see this in the film, Casa Santa Marta, the cardinals have sort of snatched conversations in hallways and visiting each other in each other's rooms. Clearly, there have to be communications between the cardinals in between votes, or clearly there's nothing you can do really. I mean, you know, it's just human nature that there will be, because so much is at stake. What do you think actually happens? How close do you think the film is to reality?
I think the film is close to reality. What happens during the voting, actually, that's taking place in the Sistine Chapel, obviously a moment of gravitas. You're in a secret room. Don't forget that if they start chattering too much, the acoustics in the Sistine Chapel are horrible. The Swiss guard outside can hear what's happening if they talk too loud. So I'm told, I've heard, again, I'm not there, so it's with that caution, of course, that in the Sistine Chapel itself, while you can lean over to your neighbor, etc., the two consecutive ballads each half day, that happens quite quietly with not a lot of chatter. The chatter happens when they leave the Sistine Chapel, when they come back, when they are at meals, at recreation, etc. When they're on the bus being transported from the Sistine Chapel back to the Domus, or when they're walking back. So that's when the chatter happens. The chatter happens when they're having a meal and someone joins you at the table for sharing lunch or dinner and never has done that before. So you see those things happening. Apparently, in 2005, there was a conversation taking place between Cardinal Ratzinger and a number of cardinals who were hesitant about his candidacy. And that conversation kind of swayed them over. But that was a conversation over, I think it was over dinner, where he talked about the church, his vision on the church, etc. So, and those conversations are actually very important. So sometimes it's with the candidates, sometimes it is about the candidate, without the candidates.
You know what happened in the case of Cardinal Bergoglio and obviously he ran, as it were, twice. He was the runner-up to Benedict in 2005. But when he did actually win in 2013, was there a moment at which he'd sort of proved himself to his audience?
So there is not that much known. There's actually more known about Benedict in terms of indiscretions than about the conclave of 2013. What you note in one of his books, I think it's the last one, where he talks about cardinals coming up to him. I think it was Cardinal Thora who came up to him and said, oh, I hear there's something with your lungs, you're missing a lung. And he said, I knew at that moment that they were talking about me. What was also clear is that in the conclave of 2005, while he was the runner-up to Cardinal Ratzinger, he made it clear to his supporters that he wasn't going to take the job if elected, that he was going to refuse. So also that is possible.
You know, some people are skeptical that he said that.
I don't know. I wasn't there. I wasn't part of that conversation. I can only relay what has been said about that. And again, that's one of those mysteries. What we know is that conversations take place. What we don't know is what exactly is being said because we're not there.
Well, I think the idea that if Cardinal Bergoglio had been elected Pope, he would have said, no, I don't want the job, is one of the most sort of extravagant counterfactuals I can possibly imagine. Only in an alternative universe is all I can say.
Maybe I'll take the analogy with episcopal appointments. Cardinal Ouellette, the former prefect of the now dicastery for bishops, once said that he was surprised once he became prefect of that dicastery that there were so many refusals of the episcopacy. And that's why it takes so long sometimes to replace someone, because someone says no and they have to start over from scratch. He used a number at one point, I believe one third or so, which I find hard to believe, but I can believe that there is.
Was this priests refusing to become bishops? I find that I've in the back of my mind with this idea that most priests would quite like to be bishops. I can imagine a bishop not wanting to be prefect of a Roman dicastery. That I can understand.
I can understand that, but I can also understand in today's circumstances that priests refuse to become bishops simply because of the responsibilities that come with it. The time is gone where bishops were princes in their palaces. Now they have to deal with all kinds of stuff that basically wears them out. The governing function takes away sometimes from their priestly joy, and they say, thank you, but no, thank you.
This is actually relevant as we speak. You know, there's always the question of things from their past which might come back to bite them. I mean, the example is the Diocese of Plymouth at the moment. Mm-hmm. Last year announced the appointment of a priest to be the new bishop. He then backed out, and his installation, he wasn't a bishop, his installation and his episcopal ordination were cancelled, and he's gone back to being a parish priest. They then appointed a bishop from Southwark, Bishop Philip Mugger, already a bishop, and the same something, more or less the same thing has happened. It's been announced that for one reason or another, he won't be taking up the job, and so now they're looking for, you know, a third Bishop of Plymouth.
That's
and
possible.
There'd be absolutely no explanation as to why.
Yeah, well, all things are possible. It could be something from someone's past, but it could also be, there are some examples of bishops or elected bishops who weren't ordained yet and who backed out because they, all of a sudden, there was this enormous pressure on them and they couldn't handle it. And that is okay. Sometimes, indeed, as you said, there's something in the background. Now, that should have been picked up during the information process when they were vetting the candidates. But sometimes a candidate simply cannot handle it.
Well, that's part of the plot of conclave, isn't it? Information from the past that derails.
That's part of that.
Spoiler.
Yeah, exactly. That's a little spoiler, but I assume.
But of course, we might be, you know, in some cases, we might be talking about, you know, malicious or fabricated allegations, but you can, anyway. So.
Well, that's the thing that Pope John Paul II was concerned about when the whole sexual abuse crisis came up. He knew how the communist regime was discrediting priests and bishops with sexual allegations. And so that's why he kind of said, piano, piano, let's take it one step at a time, not knowing that the crisis was indeed that deep, even without a communist regime fabricating things. That's a whole other story. So I can...
Now you have Beijing doing it.
Yes. So I can understand that there is reluctance to take things if there is not proof. And so it's a catch-22. I'm happy that I'm not in part of the decision-making process. I don't have to make decisions, so I only comment.
The ballots, how long does it take for a ballot to take place from the moment they walk into the Sistine Chapel to the moment they walk out, roughly?
Roughly.
I'm not talking about the final ballot necessarily, but one of the...
Well, don't forget, so everybody gets ballots, right? They have to fill them out, fold them and whatnot. And one by one, they have to come forward and put their ballot in a chalice or some other receptacle, ballot box, let's say, and then also pronounce that those words that you hear also in the movie Conclave, that they swear that they have elected the one that they think before God should be the one to be elected, put it in there. So you have that happen 138 times in this particular case, right? So not all cardinals are like you and me, running up to the altar. Most will take it slow, so have to make sure that nobody trips. There is a lot of carpet and stuff like that out there. So that takes a while.
Perhaps Cardinal Roach's background as a nice skater will help him up there to vote for himself.
So, well, actually, cardinals, that rule has been abolished. In the past, there was a rule of a two-third majority plus one to avoid that a cardinal would vote for himself. Now the assumption is that cardinals don't vote for themselves. And so it's just a two-third majority. But back to your question about how long does it take? So keep in mind, so all those cardinals have to come forward one by one, put their ballot in the ballot box. Then, presuming that everybody is in the Sistine Chapel, they get mixed, they get shaken up, and then three cardinals take them out, count them, read them, and then another three will check to make sure that's all correct, that there are no duplicates, etc., that there are 138 ballots, not 139, etc. If there is a cardinal who couldn't make it that morning or that afternoon to the Sistine Chapel because he's sick in his room, a food poisoning or something else, then three cardinals will have to go to see him, pick up his ballot, come back, put it in that ballot box, mix it in with the ballots that are already there, etc. So we're not talking about easily about an hour for that to unfold. And then once there is no election, all those ballots, what you see also in the movie Conclave, there is a needle and a cord used to go through the ballots. They're put together, bound together, and either put aside if there is no election to go immediately to round two, or after round two, or if there is an election, they bring them all to that little stove in the corner of the Sistine Chapel to be burned.
And one thing you do notice in the film is that along with the ballots goes some powder saying either white or black smoke. And I know why that happens, because in one of the conclaves of 1978, the smoke came out gray and people just didn't know whether it was white or black.
Exactly. So they add now a chemical to make sure that the smoke is indeed the color that that has to be coming out of the chimney. In the past, they added straw, which was wet or dry, and that produced either the black smoke or the white smoke. I think it's when you wet the straw, when you make it wet, that you get some white smoke out of that. But that didn't work precisely. Cardinal Simonis, the former Archbishop of Utrecht, said that at the conclave of 2005, something was wrong with that thing. And the Sistine Chapel at one point was filled with smoke. So the smoke didn't want to go out, but came in. So, which was a fun moment. So you get all these kind of things. But the truth of the matter is that we use as our only means of communication with the outside world, smoke signals to signal we're still busy, it's black smoke or white smoke, we're ready, wait for us, someone is going to be out of the balcony soon.
And it's very exciting. I'm sure you've been in Rome for the election of a Pope, but it's very exciting when, if you're near St. Peter's Square, which of course you make sure you are, when they say, well, smoke is coming out, and to sit there and watch the white smoke billow out is thrilling. And I remember sort of climbing over barriers and forcing my way to as far to the front as I could for the moment when Joseph Ratzinger came out. And what was, sorry to go on, but what was wonderful was, first of all, the joy of so many Catholics when he came out, and the fury of not so much other Catholics as the media, absolutely beside themselves with rage. The BBC correspondent was spitting. I remember myself and a priest friend ran into him the next morning. The BBC correspondent was sitting with the person from the Tablet and probably somebody from the American liberal media. And my priest friend, who was wearing a soutane, went up and said, I just wanted to offer you my condolences in your hour of grief. They didn't take the joke at all because, of course, Ratzinger was their nightmare.
Well, whoever comes out on that balcony, someone is not going to like him and someone is going to like him. So you have that with popes all the time. That's just the nature of the process, the nature of conclaves and what happens. And it's kind of interesting that you say that about Cardinal Ratzinger, because the question is, was he a favorite or was he not? Because there is that unspoken rule that the one who enters a conclave as a pope comes out as a cardinal, meaning the favorite never wins.
But but it's a sort of rule of thumb, but it's not always true. I mean, when Paul VI was elected, that was no surprise, was it?
Right.
I think he was the favorite of he was the person that John the 23rd had wanted to succeed him, and he was very esteemed for his diplomatic skills and personal holiness, I might add. It makes me unpopular with conservative Catholics when I say that I hold Paul VI in very high regard. But anyway, there we go. And Pius XII.
I think Pius
had been Secretary of State, hadn't he? So
he was. And I think, and that is interesting when you look at conclaves in terms of who comes out as Pope. Why is that? Because it's hard to predict when someone, who's going to come out, because you don't know exactly what the conversations are that the cardinals are having in those general congregations and amongst themselves. You and I might be looking at it differently. We see, oh, these are the needs of the church. They're in there. They're looking from a different perspective at the church and at the world. And your example of Pius XII is a great example. Why did the cardinals mainly elect Pius XII? He was the Secretary of State of Pius XI. Why did they elect him? Well, there was this looming war in Europe.
Indeed.
They wanted someone who could bring stability. A diplomat was the best choice and was a safe choice. That's why they elected him. So it was totally a normal choice in retrospect. Was he maybe the favorite? Who knows? It's all hard to predict who is going to come out. It all depends on how the cardinals look at a conclave.
And I think this time round, there've been, you know, Francis has made so many cardinals from the periphery, some very eccentric appointments, but the people have been passed over.
And push a little bit back against you. I have to do that from time to time.
Sure, please.
When you say it's a disgrace that people have been skipped over, maybe not. But
Archbishop Gomez, absolute disgrace.
But you have to remember, though, that who appoints the cardinals? It's the Pope. And it's his prerogative to pick who he wants. And from that perspective, it's a good reminder for all of us that Pope Francis has skipped over those who are in what was called by some the media cardinal sees. There are no cardinal sees. The Pope is free to elect who he wants in his College of Cardinals. That's one thing. It's in a way a kind of a gamble because so many cardinals do not know each other.
Yeah.
For two reasons. One, remember, I said earlier, the College of Cardinals, until the changes that Paul VI instituted with the maximum of 120 electors, well, a maximum that the Pope can always supersede, right? Instead of the fixed number of 70, well, that changes your dynamics in the college without any doubt. And so who gets known? People who have either a certain function or who are very vocal. To that point, in 2005, you had a rather large College of Cardinals, a large electoral college, 117, only 115 participated. And so in a way, it was normal that someone like Ratzinger came out because he had been the face of one of the prime dicasteries of the Roman Curia. He had been a prolific author. So if you as a fellow cardinal didn't know him, well, shame on you, that meant you didn't read books, right? And so holding an office in the Roman Curia sometimes comes at a disadvantage, but sometimes as an advantage. So you never know how that's going to play out. And so these cardinals from the periphery, we don't know them. Someone of them can indeed be elected, or they might just go for someone they know because of an office that they hold. So it's one thing. So you have a bigger group, and it's much more difficult to know people in a bigger group, to really know them. Imagine you go to college and you have this big class, this big course, where there are about 200 students. You're not going to know all of them. If you're in a little seminar style class of 15 students, most likely you're going to develop some form of relationship with your fellow students and get to know them better than if you were in a big group. That same dynamic plays in the College of Cardinals, no doubt. And so that's why those roles of dean, camerlengo, etc. are important roles. The fact that Cardinal Re is no longer an elector, he gives the homily at the funeral mass and at the mass for the Holy Spirit at the beginning of the conclave, but it doesn't play to his advantage because he's not an elector. To that effect, in 2005, when Cardinal Ratzinger was the dean, that homily at the funeral of John Paul II, that homily at the beginning of the conclave, they were really decisive moments because they got to see him. He had an advantage over other candidates.
On the day Benedict was elected, on the morning, I ran into Father Andrew Greeley, the late Father Andrew Greeley, very left-wing priest who was also a sociologist and also the author of popular potboiler novels involving the clergy and love affairs and things like that. Very unusual man, but he wrote the most gripping book called The Making of the Popes about the two conclaves of 1978, one of my favourite books, certainly on that subject. And I ran into Father Greeley, who I recognised immediately, and I said to him, who's going to win? And he said, Ratzinger. And his eyes were blazing. He was really angry. He said, Ratzinger. He said, that homily wasn't a homily. It was a victory speech. And he spat it out furiously, which I kind of felt was a bit of a historic moment for me to run into Father Greeley at that point.
Well, it's interesting because after that homily, and you're talking about the homily at the beginning of the conclave, right?
Yes.
It's interesting because obviously I was watching that. I was actually in a TV studio at that time, and there were mixed feelings as everybody was watching it. And I was listening to journalists, how they were analyzing it. And one said, oh, that's a political speech. Another said, oh, he just ended his campaign. He's not going to be elected. And so people looked at it differently. But again, from the perspective of secular journalists who don't know the inner workings of the church. And for a lot of cardinals, it was as if they were listening to the best piece of music in their life.
Yes.
Got elected. So again, all bets are off.
All bets are off. I'm looking at the favorites at the moment. I mean, I've made it clear that I think Parolin would be, just because Parolin is well known. I mean, I think that's, he's I think he wants the job desperately, and he will try and make good use of the fact that he's so well known. He's managed to cultivate so many friendships. Some other cardinals, I mean, there are a large number of cardinals who I think I'd be happy with, and they wouldn't all be conservatives by any means. I mean, I quite like Cardinal Zuppi, for example. I'm a big fan of Cardinal Pizzaballa of Jerusalem, and he's not somebody you can put into the conservative or the liberal camp. And there's a couple of conservatives I think are good as well. Cardinal Wim Eyck, is that how you pronounce it?
Von Eyck, yes.
Who was a really high-flying young medical doctor before he became...
Yes, yeah. But he got, when he was still bishop of, I think it was bishop of Groningen, before he became archbishop of Utrecht, before he became a cardinal, at one point he was out for, I think, over a year. He had this nerve disease in his face, and it was so painful, he actually went to Germany for medical treatment, if I remember correctly. So yes, his name, I've heard him as well as a possible candidate.
He's interesting because he's a conservative candidate who has attacked Francis quite clearly. I mean, he's criticized Francis in very, very forthright terms. That will make it more difficult for him to get elected, I should think.
I'm not sure. And I'm not sure.
Well, maybe not.
I'm not sure.
Maybe they'd work it out.
Again, so there's one other dynamic that you have to be aware of in a conclave. In between the beginning of the sede vacante and the election of the new pope, when the new pope is elected, for the first time for most cardinals in their life, and for some of them the last time in their life, they are free to finally speak their mind and make a decision that won't have immediate repercussions for them. Well, it has repercussions for people, but not immediately for them. They can do what they want. And so you never know how the dynamics are in a conclave. You mentioned Cardinal Parolin. While he's not a favorite of yours, don't forget we're in a situation where the world is on fire. And are we going to have a repeat of 1939 where the cardinals say, oh, we need a diplomat, safe choice? I'm just asking the question.
The man who's presided over the biggest diplomatic disaster in the history of the Catholic Church, the surrender of Chinese Catholics to their persecutors and captors.
Well, again, I'm not saying one thing or another. What I'm saying is it depends on how the cardinals see that in a conclave.
That's what you call diplomacy, allowing a communist apparatchik to appoint himself Bishop of Shanghai and then the Pope humiliated by having to sanction the appointment, which he wasn't even told about. If that's diplomacy, if that makes Cardinal Parolin a safe pair of hands, then God help
him. I didn't say that. I said how...
No, I know you didn't. I'm not putting words into
your
mouth.
You're putting words in my mouth.
But so, actually, it's a good point. It's a good point, and it's a worrying, from my point of view, it's a worrying point. But, I mean, there are lots of people who, in the past, I would have considered absolute disasters. And now there are times when I think... I mean, I've spent most of my career at loggerheads with Vincent Nicholls, but he's changed. And, I mean, he would be an old pope, but he's changed.
Look, you have your perspective. I have my perspective. We're outside observers, right? Looking at dynamics in the church, dynamics at a conclave. We're looking, we both don't have glasses on right now, but when we put our glasses on, we're looking with these glasses from our perspective. The cardinals in conclave may have a different perspective. It depends on what's happening, when the conclave takes place and whatnot. And sometimes they see things differently. They may not have the information, etc., etc. So there are a lot of unknowns out there that we're not aware of, or that we don't have any control over, or that they are not aware of. All of that is put in a mixture, and then something comes out. And that's the dynamic of the conclave. We may not like what comes out. We may have different preferences. We may have a different read. But that's how it works. To your point about, pope is older, sometimes the cardinals may go for an older pope because they want to have another choice in a few years. That's true. But be careful. That could be dangerous because in 1878, when Leo XIII was elected, the cardinals thought, we have to find someone who is old and sick and who won't stay long with us because we cannot have another pontificate like the one of Pius IX. And lo and behold, Leo XIII was pope for over 25 years. So their calculations were wrong. So I guess someone didn't find the pillow, but that said.
Well, from what I take from this, I mean, the point that really struck me, mm-hmm, was you're saying that, first of all, it's the first time the cardinals are free to make a decision for which they won't be held immediately accountable. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we can't necessarily, our reading of them may be wrong. But the other thing is, of course, is that they may not have the information that they need. And this is a personal point of mine, but I will die on this particular hill. They did not, and we still do not have the information about Jorge Mario Bergoglio that they needed then and we still need now. His past in Argentina, his links to various people. By the same token, lots of people wouldn't have known very much about Carlo Voitua. Not how, you know, he didn't even know how to pronounce his name. I remember an Australian friend.
Well,
who is this Cardinal Wodger? But that turned out, I think that turned out extremely well.
Look, with Cardinal Voitua, when he was elected, the Cardinals took a big chance, because I remember when Pope Benedict appointed a new archbishop in Warsaw to succeed Cardinal Glemph, something got wrong there in the information period as well, and the new archbishop turned out to be a spy for the Stasi, the secret police under the communist regime. So if something in your vetting went wrong and that person goes up, there's always something out there that people do not know about. One thing to keep in mind as well is that, in addition to what I've said, in a conclave, you also have some other dynamic going on. A conclave usually is, for lack of a better term, some form of a course correction with regard to the pontificate that's just over. We always summarize it in kind of visual terms. After a short pope, you have a tall pope. After an old pope, you have a younger pope. After a thin pope, you have a fat pope. That doesn't sound very respectful.
There's also a version of it I've heard from various priests, which is that a gay pope succeeds a straight pope.
Whatever. Let's not go there. But after that long pontificate of John Paul II, you needed someone who could bring some calm and who would be shorter in line. So that's why you had the election of Benedict to some extent. You can explain it from that perspective as well. Same thing after Pius XII. You had another type of pope that they elected, John the 23rd. And you see that, look at history, there is this kind of swing of the pendulum, for lack of a better term, that you will see, just to kind of make sure that all things come in moderation, or that things are kind of moderated after time. And in the end, we also have to trust. Don't forget, this is not an election for parliament, not an election for president. It's not a political election, although we sometimes say that there are politics involved. Although then I always say, no, there are no politics in the church, only politicians. And then we move on to the next topic. But don't forget, this is an ecclesial event. This is something where we believe that there is, to some extent, guidance from the Holy Spirit. That doesn't mean that the Holy Spirit intervenes right away there. But we do hope that we're part of a bigger plan of God for the church and the world, and that there is the working of the Holy Spirit through the cardinals. So we should never give up that hope and that belief.
Well, Dr. Kurt Martens, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. I'm sure both of us will pray for the Pope as he undergoes this ordeal, whether he recovers from it or not. Ultimately, we are talking about the horrible ordeal of an 88-year-old man with double pneumonia. Dr. Kurt Martens, I'm very grateful indeed. What fun to have this conversation, and I do hope you'll come back on despite my interruptions.
Thank you very much for having me.